Hey, Mike?
Yeah.
Hey, what's going on? It's Andy.
Oh, hey, Andy. How you doing, man?
I'm good. I'm just wondering if now is a good time to talk.
You know, it's as good as any.
All right,
I'm actually in a quiet place and not running around on the streets.
All right. Well, then I caught you at the right time.
So you run a podcast basically on your memories of Reston and all the bands there and all the music scene that happened in Northern Virginia when you were in, like, high school and stuff. And you get this way you get to go get in touch with guys you haven't talked to in years and stuff. And you're living in L.A. now. Is that right?
Yeah. And you know, I noticed that it seemed like there hadn't been any historical record or document done on that scene.
Yeah,
you know,
pretty seminal bands and stuff that kind of did do some action. You know, the guys from Avail are doing a reunion this year, and that's going to be huge. I mean, they sold out all the shows almost already, way before it was, you know, as soon as they put the tickets on sale. So there's a band from Reston that, you know, basically started, you know, out of the Reston scene that's doing historically relevant stuff. I'll tell you my story about Reston. I got out of Reston about as fast as I could because I had moved there from, you know, like a blue collar upstate New York, terrible, you know, kind of cold, snowy upstate New York, where my dad had a job in Rochester, New York. But he got hired to start USA Today and become the first sports editor there. So I ended up moving to Reston. I was already kind of in high school when I got there, you know, and I'd already lived in a bunch of other cities because my dad's job would change all the time. So I probably lived in about 10 different places by the time I was 12 years old. And I got to Reston. I knew immediately it was a very strange place. You know, it was 1984 was coming up, and it was like 1984, the Orwell. You know, I was like, wow, this is so bizarre. Like, you got to go get your photo ID taken at the ROA Homeowners Association. You're part of this corporate suburb that really wasn't a town. There was no elected officials. You were just like a serf in this kind of, you know, Gulf, and Mobil Oil had owned the property, and some guy from the New York Times. And it was just all very mysterious. And it wasn't like any place I'd ever lived. And, you know, I immediately was getting rebellious listening to The Clash and punk rock. And the rest didn't fit completely in my dystopian, you know, outlook of the world, and probably warped me heavily, you know.
Restopian.
Yeah, Restopia, man. It was a bizarre, like, you know, all the just the way everything was all planned and laid out. There was no, you know, there was no normal town anarchy. Like, yeah, then somebody just opened a store there. No, everything was on the master plan, and it was just very bizarre. So, you know, I immediately hooked up with those guys and that were in Foundation later. They were in a band called Pudwack back then, and I had come from upstate New York, where I was already getting into alternative music was starting to happen in the early 80s there. So, you know, whatever that might be, punk rock and little things like you might get a Trouser Press magazine and you could read about Lydia Lunch or the Dead Kennedys or something. But these were things I was never going to experience probably until we got closer to D.C. They would take me. I remember the first show Mike Davis and those guys invited me to see was like Minor Threat with the Big Boys and Trouble Funk. And, you know, like incredible things I never thought I would, you know, be around were happening in the D.C. scene back then. So I got really hooked on the, you know, punk rock scene. We all had to have our own bands eventually, and I had one called Tooling for Bovine. We're all nerds, and weirdos and outcasts, and we had a Casio keyboard and an old Dan Electro guitar amp, and we just play in my garage, and eventually they invented the rest in Battle of the Bands. It was probably like 84 or something like that, and I went down there with, you know, these guys, and I remember banging a chain on the stage and doing some kind of industrial act because we couldn't really play any, you know, decent rock and roll covers even. So we were just kind of a crazy thing. And eventually, I think I got, it was the first place I ever got banned from. And then pretty soon that became a pattern in my life, you know.
Yeah, somebody told me you got banned for banging the chain on the stage. You did so much damage to, like, the Reston Community Center.
Yeah.
Scratched it up or something.
I don't know if I really did, but it was scaring people because, you know, there was this guy with a buzz cut, you know, banging a chain on the stage, you know, bike chain or something, and freaked them out. So then I wasn't invited back the next year. Our band wasn't allowed to play. But, you know, I was setting in motion the whole chain of sequence. I got to such a crescendo in wrestling. I was literally expelled from high school there because they had some kind of Christian guy that was running the high school, and we got in some conflicts. And I was actually a student government officer. I had been voted the vice president of the class or something, and my campaign speech was, "Don't vote for me. It's bad for you." And immediately everybody voted for me, and all of a sudden I was saying stuff like, "We're going to have the prom in my basement, and we're going to give all the money to the homeless." And, you know, immediately I was on a bad trajectory with the administration. They didn't want me anywhere near the, you know, organizing events, and they banned me from appearing on any events at the school on stage. And Steve Covert, who was later in the go-go band Split Decision, was on stage with me at some event. We dressed up like the Wild and Crazy Guys from Saturday Night Live, and we had our shirts unbuttoned down to our waist, and we had, like, you know, hairsprayed cat hair to give ourselves hairy chests. And we were wearing, like, gold medallions and walking around, like, with exaggerated, you know, gyrations of our crotches, and it just offended all these people, and we were banned from appearing on stage. But then there was a talent show coming up, and I had somebody else sign up under a different, you know, they didn't know I was in the band. And so when my band was going on stage, and I think by this point my band was called Jesus Freak, and, you know, that pissed people off. And we were getting ready to go on stage, and somebody noticed that I was in the band when the curtain was drawn, and they wouldn't lift the curtain because they saw I was in the band and I wasn't allowed to go on stage. So one of the administrators, like, got on a mic and went, "I call upon the senior class to deal with this problem." And then all the jocks that had hated my guts for, you know, several years now because, you know, for various reasons, jumped up. And they had an excuse now to, like, take me out. And so I had this wrestling match going on behind the curtain, and I ran out and, you know, had to sit in, and then some parents got involved. And I just remember running out of the parking lot and hiding in the woods across from South Lakes. And, you know, it was a bad scene. I was expelled from school. And basically my tenure as a member of the wrestling scene was starting to die right about the same time it was, you know, I was having the most impact. So I had to go to a Christian school in Southern Virginia where I could even get a high school diploma instead of a GED or something. My parents found a school that was like a Baptist Christian thing. I could do a few months and pick up the remaining credits I needed to get out of Virginia high school. And I basically was still going to shows in D.C. with all my friends. We saw so many great bands at the D.C. Space and the 930 old location. Got to see Big Black and, I don't know, just all the great bands that were in the area, too. Honor Roll was a favorite of ours, and the Alternatives was from Reston. There was this guy, Greg Ottinger, who's the guitar player of the Alternatives. They were living in Richmond. We'll be right back. and there was people, you know, cross-pollinating. We knew a lot of people from the Richmond scene that were getting involved in bands, so there was a lot of, you know, guys in Guar would be dating, you know, somebody whose sister was from Reston, and we all knew each other, and we would go see these bands down in Richmond, and I don't know if you had any specific questions. I just trying to remember. It's 30 years ago for me, so more than 30. So it's hazy, but I had a great time, but I had to get on a Greyhound bus and head out to San Francisco one day when I got a DUI on my way home from, like, a big black show. And so it wasn't a DUI. It was a snowstorm. I trashed my car. I'd already gotten a DUI, and that was it. I couldn't pay my DUI fines in Virginia, and it was $99 to move to San Francisco. So at age 18, I split as soon as I was legally able.
And so what were you playing? Like, what were, in terms of music, like, what was your background musically?
Well, you know, I wasn't really technically trained. I had interest in music, and I had interest in rock and roll as a communications medium, but I wasn't a particularly adept guitarist. I had a Gibson SG, and, you know, Dan Electro amp, and I was kind of really influenced by the Jesus and Mary Chain, who had just come out. And so they had a huge feedback kind of sound I was really into. And so that was like my band Jesus Freak was sort of, you know, we were starting to take LSD, you know, and we were just experimenting. And I had a bunch of, you know, punk rock, of course, was a huge thing, the Rites of Spring, and emo was starting to happen in D.C. or whatever they called it later. And so there was a mesh of influences. Of course, we loved, you know, just radio-ready, you know, things that were, like, happening in indie rock, like R.E.M. or the bands with keyboards or whatever that was all popping in the early 80s. But I didn't have a chance to really develop a strong musical I can't read sheet music or anything like that. But when I got to San Francisco, I still had friends from Reston who had already moved out to this area. So we immediately started a band out here called the Bedlam Rovers, which was more of a Celtic folk kind of influenced punk band. And we, you know, kind of like whatever, like Flogging Molly does today. We were trying to do that 30 some years ago. And we ended up like opening for the Pogues when they first came out to the West Coast and, you know, did some touring, played some festivals, and they continued on without me. After, like, in 1989, we'd been a band for a couple of years already. We would play with random things. We would get on bills with, like, Operation Ivy or the Dead Milkmen, or, you know, MDC was good friends of ours, the Millions of Dead Cops. I lived with Millions of Dead Cops, and so we would play, you know, we would be popular with both crowds, punk crowds, folk music crowds, indie rock crowds, and, you know, I was kind of the feisty, I don't know, the redneck Shane McGowan or something. Yeah. And then, but I couldn't sing great either. I didn't really have the pipes to, you know, stay on key at all times. You know, we would cover AC/DC, but we would also play our own folk. I'll send you some links. I think I have an album you can access on Spotify. That's a Bedlam Rovers live show. It's pretty much the last live show, which I think was recorded literally 30 years ago this month. And it was the last live show where I was the lead singer. And there was a woman named Caroline Beattie who could sing, but she was also playing flute at the time. She's from Reston, and she's still active here in music in the Bay Area. She has an Eno tribute band that just performed last month that sold out this local club. I'm still in touch with her. She was in the band with me, but, you know, it's time for her to assume the, you know, more legitimate singing approach. And so I was sort of voted out of the band again, once again. It's time for me to be banned from the band. And I started a new band called with these guys from a band called Bomb that were a, hard rock, punk rock, acid rock, kind of San Francisco aggressive band. They were on Boner Records, which, you know, says it all. And they were touring a lot, but they had a lull going on because their guitar player had moved to France and things were happening. They were having label interest, but nothing was finalized. So we did a band for about a year with some members of the Bedlam Rovers, like the drummer was from Reston, and I was in it. That went on for about a year. We did some recording and never really toured on that. There was drug problems.
Last night I had this dream, right, that I was in the Oakland Coliseum, and there were all these people screaming my name, and they were, like, paying $1,000 to see us. And that's how I knew it was a dream. My mom smokes pot.
You know, just sort of, I realized being in a band is like being in a marriage, and you have, like, you know, 6-7 people, 12 people maybe. It's difficult to, so I moved higher on the food chain and figured, well, if I'm in the band, I can only play at the club once a month or something like that, or, you know, once every once in a while. If I'm the sound man, I can get paid every night. So I eventually became the sound man, the promoter, the booking agent, and I moved into performing less on stage and trying to force my, not particularly talented musical abilities on the world, and just really focus on promoting other musicians who I felt like maybe didn't have the skills I did to be a promoter, and they're too busy actually learning how to play guitar and sing and stuff. So I became working in a lot of nightclubs and things. So I was booking agent for bands and promoted a lot of shows. I got involved with the Bedlam Rovers out here with a collective called Commotion International, which was a recording studio, and it also was a performance space. And we hosted a lot of great shows there, all ages shows in San Francisco, which was pretty rare at the time. And we would have bands come in like Chumbawamba or Primus or Grotus used to rehearse there. And, you know, they would play there. We'd put together a lot of benefits for causes, like Food Not Bombs was a popular cause that we would always be raising money for, or other mostly left-wing nonprofits and stuff would approach us, and we would host nights. We'd put together shows, and a lot of touring bands would contact us. So we had, I mean, on the first San Francisco shows by Rancid or whatever was there, and other bands. I'm trying to think, man. There was a lot. There's a whole list online somewhere. You can look up every band that ever played at Commotion. We were able to keep that space going for years until the police finally shut us down. No, once again, we were shut down. And that, then I moved out of the San Francisco for a while and just tried to keep my booking agency going as a one-man shop in the early 90s when, you know, I remember I was putting on a Grota show the day that Kurt Cobain offed himself or hit the media, and, you know, the show was canceled, and, you know,
April 4th, 94.
Yeah, it was a heavy time, and I had them booked up in Santa Rosa somewhere, and they, you know, it wasn't worth nothing. None of the shows happened that day. I remember Mike Watt was scheduled to play maybe in San Francisco, and he didn't end up playing, or Firehose, whatever it was at the time. There was a lot of shows were canceled when that happened in those days. And I stayed with rock and roll as long as I could, but there was no way to make money out of it because the money was coming in so hot and heavy that the bigger labels and the bigger booking agencies were very competitive, and I couldn't compete. You know, I was just a one-man. I had my own fax machine, but that's about all I had. I didn't have the, you know, Green Day would go, hey, well, we're getting a booking agent in Beverly Hills. And, you know, I used to call Billy Joe up at his house, and, you know, he'd be, you know, his uncle would answer the phone, and, you know, he'd be like, he went off to Beverly Hills to get himself a manager. And I'd be like, I guess he's not playing any more shows for me, man. You know?
And they were never heard from again.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I've met those guys once in a while, but they're in a different tax bracket, that's for sure. they have more people working for them than, you know, used to go to their shows, you know, so it's changed a lot.
Was there ever any thought about sort of becoming the man, or, you know?
That was the thing. My ethics are so, you know, like, I'm just a DIY guy, so I couldn't really, like, you know, I was working with bands on Epitaph Records and stuff like that, but it was, the money was, you know, such a commercial, you know, people were driven by money, and I'm just not, you know, which is what I just couldn't, I wasn't, you know, I came from, I was into punk rock because it was whatever. I was all, my brain was maybe all fucked up by all the, you know, maximum rock and roll DIY ethics. So I could never actually, you know, if you could make minimum wage doing what you love, then you're an asshole. So I couldn't really see myself doing some of the moves that I saw other people making to get the money. I just couldn't ethically position myself and hardball people and, you know, steal an act from another show, or, you know, just the stuff that went on in the clubs. Some of the worst people in the world are involved in the music business, let's face it, you know, especially in the business end of it. In the musician end of it, there's all kinds of great guys who are just, that their hearts are in the right place. But when you get up to that level where you're working with club owners that are corrupt or drug addicts, and it was difficult. So I eventually just had to kind of hang up my rock and roll cleats. I'm still involved in music, mostly as a fan. I film a lot of shows, and I'm editing a video right now, and you called, of, like, Elvez last night played in San Francisco, and he's, you know, this great Mexican Elvis impersonator who puts all this, you know, meaning into the lyrics and changes them up, and he's just one of the most incredible live performers I've ever seen, and I'm just editing a video for him, but basically for free, just because I want him to have this quality footage with four cameras at his show last night, you know. If I were to try to sell my service to do that, I would have to charge thousands of dollars probably, and it would never make it. No one's going to hire me anyway for that. I'm caught in a trap. I can't walk out because my foot's caught in this board of fat. Why can't you see? Statue of Liberty. I am your homeless giant and weary. We can grow on together. It's immigration time.
Immigration time.
And we can build our dreams. It's immigration time. Yes, I'm trying to go. You know, I don't have the super 4K cameras. I just can bring everything I have in one bag and set up in a club and not take up a lot of space. And I've gotten it down to a little bit of a science where, you know, I can have a YouTube channel that has millions of hits on my videos. But, you know, if I make a few pennies a month on ads, you know, that's about, you know, if it doesn't even pay for my broadband account, you know. So it's a hobby, and I think that keeps it pure. I love music, and I help bands. I'm working with this band called the Rubenews on some videos right now. They actually paid me some money, which is, you know, amazing. Usually nobody has any, but they've been a band so long, maybe they have a savings account. So they gave me some money to film one of their shows recently, and they got a new album coming out on Yep Rock. And they've been a band for like 40 years. They're kind of inspirational to me because they've been a band since like the 70s, and they sing. They're like a whole rock and roll history lesson when you go see them.
I want to tell you a story. Woo! A bad story. About my town, Berkeley, California. Thank you. Do you remember the things you used to do? The bands in the plaza, playing it new. Down in the basement.
What was, when you got out to San Francisco, because you were involved, you know, both with the punk scene in D.C. and the punk scene in San Francisco, like, what were the similarities and differences between those two
scenes? It was weird. I remember when I first got here, you know, it's kind of like almost like a, basically like a teenage runaway. And I ran into Brian Baker from Dag Nasty was playing, and I went by their show, and he was like, he's from D.C., you know, the straight edge scene was real big. And he looked at me and he's like, what are you doing here? I'm like, oh, I'm in San Francisco now, man. I moved out here and, you know, I'm hanging out at their show. I got no money. You know, I probably helped them load their equipment in or something to get in. I knew Colin. Colin had played drums and touring for Bovines. Like, Colin Sears was a great friend of ours, part of that whole thing when we were starting our bands in the Reston area, was we would bond with other little communities of weirdos, like the guys in Bethesda or whatever, where they had their own bands and their battle of bands at their high school, and we'd go to their battle of bands. So Colin Sears from, you know, what later became Dag Nasty with Roger Marbury, we're both in this band Bloody Mannequin Orchestra that Mike Davis was real tight with, and he did Los Vampiros with those guys and stuff. I had to go see these guys, and Brian looks at me and says, what are you doing in San Francisco? I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm just out here. And he was like, you need to come back to D.C. and live in Dag House. He didn't want me to die. He was worried that, like, in San Francisco, the drug scene was so pervasive, intravenous drugs in particular. You know, he was worried I'd be dead, you know, because a lot of people did die out here. I mean, I worked with a lot of people that became addicted to drugs. They couldn't, you know, hold their bands together. You know, their whole lives were spent just chasing dime bags or whatever it is people do when they're strung out. And so there is a problem out here as far as, like, San Francisco is a mess as far as the city goes. If you're a permissive drug person, you know, there's no limit to your depravity. And the city hands out, like, millions of free needles a year. So it's, like, it's just literally, if I walk out of the building I'm in right now, I'd probably have to step over a couple guys that'll be strung out or spun out or whatever they're on. And it's crazy. So that was a big difference from D.C. where it was, you know, the straight edge thing was really tight when I was a young guy. So I was drinking, but I was never into the serious, you know, hardcore intravenous drugs anyway. You know, try this or that, but I never got into that, you know, level of it. It didn't look like a party to me. It looked like, you know, a pain in the ass, and it is. You know, people get sick and die. So that was a big change. I remember just Brian Baker, like, scared to death. I was in San Francisco. Like, I was probably coming out here to, you know, become a junkie or something. And, you know, that helped me keep my perspective. You know, I was like, well, I don't, you know, I think growing up in an area like D.C. where there was that straight edge thing, you know, it provided a good perspective, whereas a lot of people just become rock and roll burnouts, and they don't really have that perspective of, like, you want to be in control of your life, not, you know, get sucked into the gutter, you know? I mean, it's not saying I didn't, you know, smoke my share of this and that or whatever, but, you know, I didn't, also, I wanted to, you know, have something to live for the next day. And I think that being very productive too is really cool about the DC scene when you watched bands like Discord or all these guys in high school putting out albums and accomplishing things that, you know, are still great accomplishments much later in life. They, you know, those early Discord records and things like that that came out are still testaments to a time and an age. I mean, there's films about it and books about it, and you know, it is well documented, unlike say the Resident scene, which was more of a suburban offshoot and didn't have the media, and you know, didn't have the, you know, let's just say it wasn't as elite, that it was covered as, you know, profusely. It's definitely a, you know, it's a different thing. It's out in the suburbs, man. It's kind of underground, and that was kind of cool too.
Is there a suburban San Francisco scene?
Sure. I mean, I'm older now, so I don't know. I mean, I should be having my own kids that would turn me on to that stuff. But, you know, there's an outer ring of suburbs, like a Beltway type vibe out in the Bay Area. They have some very, you know, tidy suburbs around here with some very rich folks living out in the, you know, wooded, gladed areas outside of, you know, the city. And I don't know what most of those kids are up to. Again, a lot of them look to what they see in the media to ascertain. I don't know that they come in. We don't really have we have Gilman Street, which was a great suburban, it's in Berkeley, so it was kind of a suburban all ages version. San Francisco is a very expensive urban city to live in, so the kids don't necessarily come in here like we used to go into DC to see shows. I think, you know, with the internet has changed a lot of things too, how people absorb culture and how they get their music. And I mean, I walked by a venue last night that was having a huge rave, and I didn't even know who the headliner was, some guy named Juice WRLD, and he had like 10,000 teenagers trying to get into this place, or 5,000 teenagers, whatever it was. And I had no, you know, I'm just going, I don't even know who that is. I'm walking down the street to go to, you know, some club with, you know, a couple hundred people. And so there is, you know, obviously the youth culture is still happening. I just don't know what it is, man. I was involved when I was younger. Like one of the things I did when we were out here is, Fugazi, for example, would come out from D.C., and I'd be part of the crew that would, you know, basically volunteer to try to put on a Fugazi show, which became such a huge undertaking in the, by the mid-90s, that it was hard to find venues large enough to put on a Fugazi show, because we'd start with, you know, some community hall or something that would hold 200 people, but it would sell out in minutes. And so eventually we had to start renting out, like, literally hangars. You know, like a military hangar down by the pier where you could put 5,000 people, and then you're like $5 a head. Okay, that's Fugazi's rule. How are we going to afford a PA at $5 a head? Like a good PA costs, you know, $10,000 to rent as it is. You need a professional sound system with monitors and stacks and PAs and amplifiers and generators to, you know, do kind of stadium level production, because they were an arena rock band almost. But it's spun so, you know, they've gone from being, you know, just a small DC space band to this huge, you know, nationally known entity. And people would drive in for hours from the places I'd never even been to. They'd be like, where'd this guy come from? In a pickup truck. He's heard of Fugazi and he's here to slam in the pit, you know, and he's, you know, some guy from out in farm country. And they'd come into town, and we literally, one of the last shows I was involved with them, we had to borrow a PA from the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Pearl Jam. Yeah. So basically, it was corporate rock anyway. So I was like, this is the scale. This is how it's heading. Like, to even meet the demands of indie rock, we still need corporate rock. You know, so it was like, I don't even know if we can do this. You know, this indie rock dream, maybe it's just we're fooling ourselves, because Fugazi's the biggest indie rock band, but without Pearl Jam's fucking PA, man, we can't even do the show. You know, like, no, we can't afford a real one. And thank God the Red Hot Chili Peppers will lend us theirs, because they're not using it tonight. You know, but it was like kind of that ridiculousness, you know.
That's awesome. And that's awesome that they lent it out and that the show was able
it was
to,
a funny
to happen.
Thing. Yeah, a lot of people would volunteer to help with this Fugazi show. She might have like 100 volunteers all wearing T-shirts. You know, that said, like, staff or whatever, and we're all just, nobody's getting paid. We're all doing this for free, essentially. And I'm like, well, at least if we work for the corporate rock promoter, you know, somebody would cover my lunch or something, right? You know, like, I'm busting my ass here, but Fugazi's getting paid. Why are we all got to work for free? You know? And then I remember the guy from Pearl Jam shows up and he tries to get in at the door. He's like, yeah, I'm in Pearl Jam. And they're like, $5, dude. And he's like, he's like, that's my PA. And they're like, so $5, bro. You know, like, they don't know who he is. And we're just like, ah, whatever. You know, it's too late. I think his wife had to fish around the bottom of her purse to find some money. Cause they, you know, I'm in Pearl Jam. I don't need money. You know, like I'm cool. You know? I remember I'd come back from, you know, being in San Francisco, and we just roll into a town like Charlottesville and just drive down to WTJU in the middle of the night. You knew there was some college DJ in there all alone. We'd just find the left of the dial station. We'd roll up in there, and we'd knock on the door of the college radio station, and they'd let us in, you know. And then we'd just come in and like, hey, we're from San Francisco. I got some guys from bands here. We want to play some of their records. We want to get on the air. You know, and we'd play all our friends' records if they had them. They're like, oh, look, Alternative Tentacles sent this. Let's play the Beatniks. For the first time, we would get on the airwaves because we would come from San Francisco literally as, you know, the, you know, we didn't send an email. We'd just be there, and we'd actually play the records on the radio in the middle of the night. And that's how you get, you know, the word out that these, and this band's coming to town next month, so watch for them or whatever. And there was silly things like that we would do, you know, just, you know, it was a more innocent time, I think, you know, and less technically sophisticated, I guess, you know. So it was a very organic. So the DIY thing, you know, people just have each other's phone numbers, and you'd pass these phone number lists around. We'd also get, like, calling cards from some bootleg source. You had no idea how long the number would last. You'd buy a number from a guy for, like, $1. At a payphone, and he'd sell you a number, and you'd make as many calls as you could to other cities in the country before your calling card died. And it was usually within like 24 hours or 3 days or something. You'd have to like use this card to try to make some free phone calls to other cities because it was, you know, $1 a minute too if you didn't have a calling card. So I remember like Gigi Allen would be calling my house. I'd be like, I'm not picking that one up, man. You know, like people would have each other's numbers. It would just be like bizarre, you know, how we'd all find each other. I remember Fred Armisen from, you know,
Trench Mouth.
Yeah. He would stay, you know, he would come and stay at my house and I'd have his number. Like I found a post-it note the other day. I was cleaning up a room there, you know, he lived in Chicago. He had 312 phone number. There's the post-it note, like Fred. Oh yeah. I got to call him. You know, if you're going to Chicago and, you know, you call him and he sets you up with a show and vice versa. And everybody was just, you know, throwing, you know, the couch out and letting bands stay there. And I did that when I was living in Sonoma as well, when I lived up north of here a while because San Francisco got too crazy. So I decided to try to live out in the country for a minute and buy a house and be a normal person. But that didn't last very long. I had to get back into the city, mainly because I couldn't drive 20 miles to put up flyers. You know, it was a pain in the neck. You know, before the internet, you had to drive and put your flyer up in every cafe and record store. And sometimes that could take all day, you know, just going from place to place to get the word out that you had, say, Sublime coming to play in some cafe for $3 and you're begging people to come in. You know, the band ends up busking on the street just to lure customers in, and, you know, people that would later pay hundreds of dollars just to hear a tape of that day. You know, I couldn't get them to come in the club for $4 or whatever, you know, out in the sticks, you know. So I worked with Sublime for a while. That was a band that I got into in around 94. They contacted me. I just remember they sent me this demo tape, and it was like, wow, every song sounds a little bit different. And I would play it in the car driving into the city to my bartending job or whatever, my sound man jobs, and I'd play it while the shows were, you know, happening between bands, and people go, what band is this? And I'd tell them, and then they come back 10 minutes later and go, what band is this? I say, it's the same one. But they didn't believe it, you know, because Sublime had all these different styles. They would do the reggae, and then they would do the Bad Religion style punk rock, and then they would do the scratch mixing. So they had all these different things going on.
Yeah.
It's free. Anytime, just call me. 4390116. When you're down with Sublime, you get.
Again, like one of those dangerous guys bands that I would end up hanging out with, where there's going to be drug issues and, you know, it's like trying to herd cats to get them on time anywhere. And, you know, you're buying them beer and condoms and just trying to keep them alive, you know, going to skate parks. And I remember Avail came out to play with Sublime in San Pedro, which is down by Long Beach, you know, down there.
Yeah.
And there was some club there called the Waters Club. This is probably in like 95, I want to say. And Avail is coming. So I'm excited to see Tim. I used to live on the same cul-de-sac with Tim back in the day. I remember like when he first moved out from England, his dad was in there. You know, one of the things that was weird about Reston when I first moved there was nobody could tell you what their parents did because everybody's parents worked for the government. You know, and it's some top secret clearance shit. And like Tim Zab is one of those guys, right? You know, so they had just moved back from England where his dad was stationed with whatever agency he was with. And, you know, he was a heavy metal burnout and he wore the, you know, the denim vests with the Venom patches on there or whatever. He had the, you know, metal bands from England that nobody here knew about, you know. And I was the punk rocker and somebody set us up. Like it was my first week or two in the area and it was, you know, somebody was like, you guys got to fight. The metal guys got to fight the punk guy. It was like at the bus stop or something. Somebody was trying to get us to fight, you know, some ridiculous thing. But years later, here I am in San Pedro. Avail's going to play and then Sublime. And Avail actually gets their set off, but this club is starting to get real popping. And the L.A. helicopters, the cops, literally the cop copters, start circling the parking lot and sending spotlights everywhere. You know, the crowd had to scatter. The cops were going to raid this club. And, you know, it's just crazy. So Sublime never even played that night. You know, it's just like stuff like that. L.A. was such a nightmare for trying to put on shows. It was kooky, you know. The way they treated the cops were just so adversarial for decades with all the, you know, underground rock fans. You're always slightly more civilized up here. But I had a lot of problems, too, with punk rock. It was my downfall, too, with all my people that would put on shows with me. I'm like, dude, you have to bring in all these bands with all these aggro fans. And shit would happen. Like, I'd book NOFX, and, you know, some skinheads would show up to shut the show down or something. And you'd get in these crazy situations with, you know, police and... you know, your club would get shut down because the fans were just not mature enough to handle it. Somebody would want to break the sink or all that shit that goes with punk rock.
Well, it sounds like your life in Reston kind of prepared you for all that to some extent.
The things about Reston would prepare me with just it embittered me against the system or whatever. I was already probably headed that direction already, you know. You know, but Arrested was that the whole thing with that dystopian, you know, Big Brotherish, and then, you know, the complacency of a lot of my classmates or whatever in school, the members of my generation that, you know, they were blind to all this, you know, imbalance and income inequality, and just like they still are probably, you know, people are just comfortable doing what they're doing. They don't want to be challenged. They don't want to read anything. They don't want to, you know, think deeper than a lot of the surface information that is presented to us. So that's why I sought out underground music, too, is because these were the weirdos, the oddballs. I mean, I remember in D.C. as a kid, I'm already going to see cool stuff like Eugene Chadbourne from Shockabilly or, you know, guys like Scratch Acid, Jesus Lizard, David Yao type bands and all those weird industrial bands from D.C. We had like 935 Free. It was just an incredibly oddball band with like Dan Joseph and Bruce and Vance and Jason Carmer, who he lives out here. One of the guitar players in 9353 lives in the, well, he did live here in the Bay Area. I think he's moved now, but you know, he was producing bands like the Donnas and stuff out here. So some people from DC, I know one of the guys from Void's living here, you know, so there is some DC and Reston connections I still, you know, stumble across every now and then. Somebody actually stumbled into me the other day and told me somebody knew me from Reston, and I said, who? And they named the name, and I was like, I don't know that person. They said, well, they've changed genders since you were in high school. I'm like, oh, well, that explains why I don't know who that is. They have a totally different name, you know. But they were, you know, were telling somebody. I knew some crazy stories about me, you know.
Well, you know, people have mentioned whenever I brought up like Reston bands from the 80s, people there's a lot of people have mentioned Jesus Freak.
Really?
Not as many people have mentioned Toolin' for Bobon.
Well, that
but,
was just one year, you know, it was like that was probably like, you know, I was like 16 or something when we did Toolin' for Bobon. We only played like the Reston Community Center Battle of the Bands, you know. We might have had a tape out because Pugwack had a tape out, so I think we probably had to put together a tape too, you know. And I Jesus Freak, we did play some parties, you know. And Steve Covert was in it for a while from Split Decision. I remember we went through a couple permutations, and you know, it was a little bit later in high school, so we were already starting to drink and do silly stuff. But yeah, you know, I don't even know if I have a tape of it. I remember we did a song called Elvis Died on the Toilet, which, you know, I realized this year Elvis has been dead for as long as he was alive. This is the magic year where he's been dead for 42 years and he lived for 42 years. And he died in, like, you know, 1977 or whatever. But I wrote a song called Elvis Died on the Toilet, and I remember playing that one around Reston. You know, some screechy, you know. Not a reverb. I was into reverb, man. That was my main influence. I want to hear my voice twice.
Well, if nothing else, you know, the name precedes you because the, you know, people from, I mean, I can't necessarily say far and wide, but at least as far as this show goes and as wide as this show goes, you know, there were a bunch of people that were influenced or had heard about Jesus Freak.
That was going on stage. That's why I got expelled, because I was trying. I was like, I can't be banned from being on the stage. That's my First Amendment right. I got to get up there. I want to play my crazy music, you know. But they wouldn't let me, man. So I had to get out. I had to get out of Virginia, basically. They were basically calling my number, you know. It's a very conservative area. And I have a feeling if I stayed in Virginia, I'd be dead. I'm like conservative in San Francisco, you know what I mean? But in Virginia, I was a wild man. I was a radical. I was a freak, you know, and I felt like it. And, you know, so it was a relief to kind of get out to San Francisco where, you know, like I'm not the freakiest thing on the sidewalk. I can kind of be myself without having to worry that somebody's offended by my appearance or my thoughts or, you know, it's really important when you're young that you're not like, you know, completely terrorized by, you know, your fears of the police or, you know, having your freedoms taken away from you. I mean, I was getting into a lot of trouble as a young guy. And, you know, I had a bad relationship with my parents, essentially, too. So that was probably a big disadvantage. Whereas a lot of people I know who have nice, stable lives, you know, they maybe had more stable relationships with your parents, too. You know, like more loving or accepting. I'm still kind of adversarial with my parents all these years because, you know, we don't agree on, you know, much. You know, let's put it that way. So, and, you know, so that was a trouble. And I think, you know, that's who a lot of the guys in some of these, you know, more famous bands are. They're the ones that were kind of like off their rocker a little bit. You know, the rebels, you know, the ones that weren't afraid to, you know, travel around in a van. I do regret, as you know, as a young person, I didn't do more touring, but, you know, I couldn't really put together a band, you know, people that were reliable enough to want to tour, you know. So that was a problem. The Bedlam Rovers I was in, they did manage to stay together almost, I don't want to say 10 years, but they probably did like 6 to 8 years on the road. And that was, you know, it wore them down a little bit too. You know, they changed members a lot, but the core, there was a core couple in there that was from Reston. And they, you know, but then they eventually split up. It was kind of like Fleetwood Mac being in that band because we had so many people. We had like 7 or 8 members. So we had guys dating girls in the band. I mean, this is always a bad combination. I wasn't doing that particularly, but then again, I wasn't, you know, particularly, you know, monogamous with anybody. So I was getting in trouble. And, you know, we were young. We were doing a lot of, wild things, you know, and experimenting. And, you know, also we were politically, you know, far left. So I remember the Bedlam Rovers, one of the guys who put out some of their albums likes to tell a story about how he offers the Bedlam Rovers. This is shortly after I was given the boot, but he puts out their record right after I leave. And he offers them a tour with the MTV Rock the Vote tour. And they come to him, and he's like, yeah, I got this tour for you, and it's going to be great. You're going to go out there. It's going to be like Blues Traveler and a bunch of bands. And they're like, voting? We're not into voting. And he's like, no, dude, you don't have to vote for any one candidate. You just have to say voting is cool. And they're like, we don't believe in voting. You know, like, you know, he's like, what can I do? You know, so, you know, they literally would not do the tour, the MTV Rock the Vote tour, because they didn't believe voting was the solution. You know, so these are some of the, you know, people I'm, you know, trying to be in a band with. So you can imagine some of the contentious, you know, contentious band meetings we would have, you know, about directions and what shows we're going to play or what songs we're going to play. And, you know, these things all get to be troublesome. Yeah, and, you know, I remember a lot of those. I was listening to some of your podcasts, and I remember some stories there where I was like, you had guys talking about, like, Andy Gems was of my generation. Like, you know, I know he's running a club down in, like, somewhere in Richmond maybe or something like that, or someplace down to Charlottesville. I don't know. He's in Virginia still. He came out here to San Francisco for a while, worked at Yahoo when they were first so getting started. And he was, you know, the metal drummer, man. He was the heavy metal drummer in that generation. And I haven't heard somebody talking about Justin Corbett, you know, and he was a great guitar player. His brother Brendan also lived out here for a while with me, and I used to stay at a place where he was staying, and yeah, and I think even he had a little brother too.
Greg
and Brendan and Justin Corbett were all good friends of mine back then. Greg ended up, I remember for a while, was living on the roof of a nightclub, the Kennel Club that is now called the Independent. When they first came out here, these dudes would show up from rest and like, yeah, we're moving out to San Francisco because we heard it's happening. And I'd get here and you'd be like, dude, it's like really expensive. Like, this is like as much money as New York City. It's not like you just show up, you know, and they didn't have much money or anything. So they literally would just take their sleeping bags and sleep on the roof of a nightclub. You know, it was a big old nightclub. So, you know, nobody was going to, you know, really bug them. And I think the nightclub was higher than any of the other houses, so nobody could see that they were camped out up there because they kind of had the vantage point of the neighborhood, but they could kind of tuck themselves in. I don't know if they did this for a consistent amount of weeks or anything, but I do remember staying on top of a nightclub for a few nights here and there, you know, like that's where they lived because there was no, people just didn't even have extra room, you know. My story's a ramble. But I'll get you some music. I'll see what I can pull up. I know I got at least one song by my man Mom somewhere digitized, and some bands, the Bedlam Rovers. I got a few tracks that I can get you. And I don't know if I have any of the Reston era stuff, man. I don't even know. Mike Davis might have it. He's the kind of guy that archives, and you know, he lived a stable life. He came and stayed with me.
I mean, he got me the Pugwack stuff, so
yeah.
That was kind of awesome that he was able to find that. So.
I know, that was the coolest thing for me to hear in first time in how many years. Yeah, that was great. And
yeah.
He did a great job packaging all that stuff up. He scanned the liner notes and stuff too, which had these great drawings by Sean Philpotts and some really cool stuff.
That dude's rad.
Yeah,
Mike
has
been
great. I'm so glad I met him when I was the age I was, because you know he changed my life in a lot of ways because he introduced me to that. If I would have just stumbled around Reston, maybe never discovering the inner core of the DC artistic, you know, scene that we did get to enter, because you know those guys were already doing it for a couple of years by the time I arrived here. You know.
Well, listen, man. I think if nothing else, because you know, I've seen the video of you performing with Bedlam, and I thought that stuff was cool and way ahead of its time. But I would say, you know, the consistent thing from what I'm picking up from your whole career is just you've got good ears, man. Like, I mean, that's the most valuable resource in music, having good ears.
I can help a lot of artists. I mean, there were so many artists that just didn't have, you know, a way to get there, you know. So I would do a lot of promotion is what I ended up doing. I kind of started a company, an event company out here too, that we supplied.
But that's the thing. It's like you heard a band and you knew when there was something there.
Yeah.
And then you did what you could to help out or played whatever part that you played with them. But I can tell from
when they're between doing this and doing that. Like, I helped, you know, Green Day get their first, you know, shows. But I remember that one of the guys in Green Day was like, dude, what? Your club is 21 and over. We're never going to sell out. They got rid of
that. I mean, think about it. It's like just to have one of those in your lifetime that you're associated with. But like Green Day, Sublime, I mean, there are a million of them.
A heady time. I loved every minute of it. I wish I could go back and relive some of those days because it was exciting, you know. It was exciting because you never knew what was going to happen. You know, like anything could happen at these events with these bands too, because they would draw like 10 times the volume of like a regular band. You know, there'd be shows where there'd be 20 people, and then there'd be shows where did 2,000 people show up? You know, like how did the word get out? Because there was no internet. We didn't have any idea how it was traveling word of mouth. It would just boom, like NOFX would just blow up. And suddenly, like, there's no room. But I was like, the last time I saw these guys, there was 50 people. You know, like,
that's amazing. They are at a show for NOFX where there were only 50 people. That's unbelievable.
Dude, I love the story. I'll tell you this one. I was in Fat Mike's apartment one night in probably 1987 or something. He's putting out a 7-inch, and he plays it for me. And I'm just sitting there. It's like a test pressing. And he goes, dude, this is my new single. I go, what is it? And he puts it on. We've had a few beers. And he plays this song. And goes, my girlfriend's on the rag. My girlfriend's on the rag. And I just looked at him, and I looked at the record, and I was like, this poor son of a bitch, man. Oh, my God, this is the worst thing I've ever fucking heard. Like, he's going to be sitting on a pile of these, like, oh, really? Are you sure you're putting that out? He's like, yeah, we've already ordered the covers. I was like, oh, good luck with that, man. You know, and then, like, you know, who am I? He's a millionaire, you know? It's just like.
Yeah. Hey, maybe I was wrong about your ears.
Yeah. If I had a copy of that thing, you know, I could fly down to L.A., you know, and do the show down there.
When you got